Our next case this morning is Cunningham against Tegela. Mr. Reinecke.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court, Steve Reinecke for Mr. Figala and the other three named defendants in this matter on appeal from a denial of a motion to dismiss based on qualified immunity in the lower court. This is the first Amendment retaliation case involving qualified immunity for the named individual defendants. The question that I see, or the issue that I think is key to the appeal, is whether in a union activity case the pleadings that we have in this case are specific enough.
Why is this a union activity case rather than a union membership case? We are, after all, here on the complaint, and the complaint appears to allege that the plaintiff was discriminated against simply on account of his union membership. And given that we have to accept all the allegations of the complaint, don't you now have to show that it was constitutionally fine, or reasonable people could have thought it constitutionally fine, to discriminate against union members?
Well, we still have to apply the Connick analysis on the public concern.
No, we don't have to apply Connick to the extent the complaint says I was discriminated against just for belonging to the union. That's not a Connick question.
I didn't read the complaint that way, Your Honor. I read it as a bargaining case. He makes many, many references to being at the table and negotiating vigorously and not being promoted, as a product of that. He doesn't identify what the main defendant did that that prevented him from enjoying the right to speak out on this matter of public concern. And I don't think bargaining in and of itself or union activity in and of itself per se is a protected activity. I think this court in a number of cases has said that.
Not what we've said. The Supreme Court has said there's no constitutional right to engage in collective bargaining with public employers. But that's what's led to my question, whether, even that we're not at the summary judgment stage, but at the complaint stage, whether we should understand the matters as you wish us to understand them.
Well, sir, let's assume for the sake of discussion that the complaint is clear on the issue of that it's the union membership solely case.
But wait a minute. Maybe I should just follow up and say, in order to avoid some problem with our appellate jurisdiction, starting to worry about facts, we really do need to, and the Supreme Court, I think, made this quite clear in Soft Day against Katz, we need to apply something like the 12b-6 standard to the complaint. If any set of facts consistent with this document could be shown by the plaintiff, taking it in that light, has he articulated something that would be a constitutional violation? If we answer that question no, of course, then we're done, and there were no facts that needed to be looked into, even to the point of summary judgment. But if we answer that question yes, we would move on to your second point about whether that right is clearly established. But I don't think this is the time to read the complaint in a really picky way. I mean, we have said complaints are read very broadly at the 12b-6 stage. So that's where we have to be, and I think Judge Easterbrook is right. You know, one of the things he says is essentially, I'm the union, you know, they didn't like the union, therefore I was discriminated against.
That's pretty broad pleading for a qualified immunity standard, I think.
How about paragraph 85F, by discriminating against the plaintiff as a result of his union affiliation?
Right, that's a legal conclusion, Your Honor.
No, it's also a factual.
It's just a narration of the claim.
It is a narration of the claim, Your Honor, but it uses words that are technical terms, retaliation, which is the conclusion of law.
Everything in a complaint uses words that are technical terms.
It says he's complaining against these defendants because they discriminated against him because he was affiliated with the union, and that,
right.
I
didn't see affiliation in there. I saw active.
It's page 11 of your appendix. At the top of that page, paragraph 85F.
Right, and I read F again as a legal conclusion. I think Sautier says that the individual defendant should be able to read a complaint and see in it the conduct that they engaged in that the plaintiff was protected by the First Amendment on relative to public concern. The only reference to the defendants here, named defendants, is in the third count. Otherwise, we have general and vague accusations against all defendants, and I think that Sautier requires more than that. And I think this is a case, maybe the first case after Sautier for the circuit on that issue, but when I read Kuchenreuther, which is a case out of this district, when I read Walton, which is another case out of this circuit, and I read Hanover School, another case out of the circuit, I read that not all union activity is protected. So then the question becomes which is and which isn't. I think Sautier says you need to identify that conduct which is protected and put it in your pleading in order to overcome the qualified immunity argument.
You don't have to put anything in your pleading to overcome qualified immunity.
Well, then the question becomes
in Gomez against Toledo.
Then the question
one of the problems which we're obviously exploring is that if we don't really know how things are going to shake out, it is indeed premature for us to be having an appeal.
Well, that's been litigated twice, Your Honor, and Judge Guzman in this court said it wasn't frivolous, and that I assume it means it's proper for appeal. There's no harm to
there. There are a lot of things that are non-frivolous, but non-persuasive.
There's no harm to the plaintiffs here, Your Honor. They can amend the pleadings if they, in discovery, find that the individuals did something.
No, look. This whole idea of amend the pleadings, is not the way that the rules work. You file the pleadings, you file a response, and then you move on to summary judgment. That's when you start.
I understand that judgment. I'm reading the cases to say that these individuals get the earliest opportunity to get that issue determined, including a 12b6 motion. I don't think there's anything unique or special about the 12b6 analysis.
Well, they do, except that the price of that is that you have to read the complaint in the way that I described earlier, in this very broad way. I mean, if they had said, if the plaintiff had said, I'm entitled to recover because he gave me a dirty look the other day at the office, then it would be very easy for us to read that complaint and say, sorry, you just haven't even stated a claim that is going to be covered by any pertinent federal law. The defendants are entitled to be out.
Well, I don't see any specificity on the three, on the named defendants. I see their names.
Their names again. Well, they didn't promote him. They did all of these things.
But 90,
because he was affiliated.
Well, that's an inference, I think.
And that's what you do at 12b6.
Well, I think the question that would have stopped here due to inferences of 12b6. That's what the case is about. I think the question is whether or not there shouldn't be more in the pleadings, so that people who get named know what it is that they're being alleged to do.
More in the pleadings. This pleading is far too long and complex as it is. Pleadings are supposed to look like the model forms attached to the civil rules. They're supposed to be 2 pages long and just identify the basic grievance. They're not supposed to be detailed and complex. They don't have to have facts in them.
And then how does the qualified immunity issue get resolved earliest as possible in the process?
Mostly on 12b6, unless the plaintiff pleads himself out of court, which this pleading didn't, it doesn't.
Even though the court has said as early as 12b6 if possible.
You can, and the example I gave you would be a case where it would be a perfectly appropriate qualified immunity. The person has pleaded himself out of court by claiming a right to relief on a ground that's simply not available. The dirty look at the office, it doesn't violate anything. It doesn't violate 1983. It's not a bad enough thing to do.
At least not in this circuit.
Well, I'm assuming. Anyway.
I have one minute left. I'd like to save it for rebuttal. Thank you, Jordan.
Certainly, Mr. Reinecke. Mr. Hunt.
May it please the court, my name is Keith Hunt on behalf of Tim Cunningham, the plaintiff appellee. I'd like to pick up with the theme that the court has been speaking about and point out that denying this appeal will not cause any prejudice to the defendants. This case has a unique posture.
Mr. Hunt, let me tell you what my principal question is. I wonder whether you may not have pleaded yourself out of court. The claim appears, the principal grievance appears to be the lack of promotion to lieutenant. And my question is, why can't an employer insist that lieutenants, who are, seems to me, quite obviously supervisors, not be union adherents? Pretty well established as a matter of federal labor law that the employer is entitled to supervisors who are loyal to the employer's interests. So my big question is, where's the entitlement of union adherents to become supervisors?
The entitlement is that the plant, while it is true that there is no right to insist upon a collective bargaining process, once the employer has allowed that process in the door...
No, you're not grappling with my question. My question is, where is the rule that says that an employer cannot say, I hire supervisors only from among the people known to be on management's side. I do not hire supervisors from among people known to be on the union's side.
I think first and foremost that principle is found in the First Amendment, the freedom of association.
The First Amendment prevents managers from insisting that supervisors be loyal to management.
No, but as the First Amendment has been applied in the employment context to public employees, an employer cannot use the fact that an employee has exercised his First Amendment right of association or his First Amendment right of free speech against the employee in firing him, promoting him, or any other tangible job benefit or action.
But could the employer insist that if you do get the promotion to lieutenant, you resign from the union?
Well, as...
In other words, can the employer in that way... address the issue of association?
I think they have in many instances. For example, the chief is not a union member, nor any of the captains. As it turns out, in this particular instance, nor are any of the lieutenants, because the union is only consisted of the rank-and-file firefighters.
Are all of the rank-and-file firefighters union members?
I believe they are, although...
The pool would be zero for promotion if one said you can't even be in the promotion pool unless you're not a union member. So it must be a situation where they cease becoming union members upon being promoted, but they can still be union members while they're applying.
They do, although one of the facts that was developed in the course of discovery, which was ongoing on these issues in the district court while this appeal was pending, was evidence that came out that, in fact, this is precisely what the management was afraid of in this case, was that if Cunningham was promoted, he would then go ahead and try and organize the lieutenants as well. There had been some discussion of that. That was one of their fears in connection
with that. Isn't that a perfectly legitimate fear? If there's an entitlement, and I think this is one of the most firmly established entitlements, at least of federal labor law, that managers be entitled to the loyalty of supervisors, why isn't fear about whether the supervisor will in fact be loyal a perfectly legitimate consideration?
Well, there are many fears that some would view as legitimate, though they may not necessarily be legal or be legally employed as part of a decision-making process.
I'm just describing the fact that this is a perfectly legitimate criterion in everyday, ordinary labor law. These are the criteria on which employers, consistent with the National Labor Relations Act, make hiring decisions all the time, perfectly legally.
And I have to concede, Judge, that would be a legitimate expectation of an employer, that people who are in the management that would be loyal to that administration. However, there's nothing in this record, nothing that the defendants have raised, that would implicate that. That would take us into the Pickering test and the fact-intensive balancing and where we're at. And as the district court properly noted, no facts were ever alleged by the defendants in this case that would implicate the utilization of that test, at least at the 12B6 stage. As I mentioned earlier, the denying this appeal will not prejudice the defendants. Why? Because we have been going on, while this appeal has been pending, doing all the discovery in the district court. Just last Friday, September the 12th, they filed this past Monday, the 15th, they filed a motion for summary judgment. And in it, they raised the issue of qualified immunity based upon the factual record as it had been established and developed through discovery.
That
so they will have to bump that up.
The nature of these kinds of cases, because if this is affirmed, we go back and they move for summary judgment, it's granted, then you're going to be here raising all these issues again, both sides. It's such a waste of energy, I think.
And for precisely that reason, one of the things I wanted to do this morning was invite the court to reconsider that jurisdictional issue.
We can't.
We
the
can't.
Supreme Court is the one that established it.
I think we'd like to.
You need to move up before you can get that reconsidered.
In fact, we were so bold as to say that the public defendants get only one appeal, and the Supreme Court disagreed with us on that. Said they get 2, 3, 4 or more. And we're on the losing side of that, I'm afraid.
Unless we wanted to create a conflict among the circuits.
We can't create a conflict with the Supreme Court, much as we may like to from time to time. It wouldn't be seemly.
It's not a question of circuit law.
Which suggests why the more streamlined approach is looking. Notice pleading, you don't say too much, you're probably going to get past a qualified immunity 12B6 go on to summary judgment and pass the case out.
I would like to sum up by simply saying that I think this court that this case is most closely analogous to the reasoning that was employed by this court in the first Gustafson decision. In that case, the court wrestled with these very issues 6 years ago. Wrestled with these very issues about what gets raised in a pleading and whether that enables the court to engage in the type of Pickering analysis, fact-intensive balancing analysis that's required in order for the defendant to prevail on a qualified immunity defense. And in that case, the court noted that it is a rare situation indeed that this can be resolved prior to the summary judgment phase. Typically, there's at least some discovery that needs to be required. That's the point that we're at here. This court should affirm the district court's decision. As a practical matter, the summary judgment motion that's pending in the district court in all likelihood will be at least fully briefed by the time that this court reaches its decision. So, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Reinhart?
Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.